The following views and opinions do not necessarily reflect those of AM 1230 WYTS, its staff, management, or parent company, Clear Channel Broadcasting. Listeners should not use Dr. Kvitko's comments and advice in the place of receiving an actual dental exam.
Brighten your life with a smile that shows the professional touch of Dr. Kvitko.
Time now for Dentally Speaking with Dr. Brian Kvitko on AM 1230 WYTS. Call 821-1230. That's 821-1230 to discuss your dental issues. Now, here's your host, Dr. Kvitko on AM 1230 WYTS.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko. Our show is also known as Everything You've Always Wanted to Know About Dentistry, but we're too numb to ask. Hello, I'm General Dentist Dr. Brian Kvitko, and thanks so much for getting up and joining me. On the phone with us today, I'll introduce him here in a second, is a gentleman, an oral surgeon from Florida, who worked with an ophthalmological team to help restore the eyesight of a blind woman using a tooth. Yeah, I said using a tooth, so this is pretty neat stuff. I'm very excited to have him on the show with us. Before we bring Dr. Sawatari on the line, let me just go ahead and give out today's question of the day. Dr. Kvitko's question of the day is, according to the American Dental Association, oh, and by the way, if you listened to last week's show, where we had Jennifer Haywood on, and we were talking about substance abuse, this would have been a great question for last week. And Jennifer, if you're listening, feel free to call in with your guess. But the question is, according to the ADA, what percent of dentists had ever known or suspected employees' substance abuse? And anyway, that last week we were talking about that, so I could only have one question of the day per day, so I thought I'd bring this one on to this week. All right, if you want to send in a guess or call in your guess, it's 821-1230. Or you can email us. Some people are shy, they don't want to call. So email dentallyspeaking on am1230@yahoo.com. Now that might be a lot of letters to remember at 9 o'clock on Sunday morning, but I think you can handle it. So dentallyspeaking on am1230@yahoo.com. All right, the title of today's show is A Tooth for an Eye. Basically, restoring a blind person's eyesight using a tooth. And on the phone with us is Dr. Yo Sawatari. I think I just messed that up. Sawatari, I think it is. Doctor, did I get that right or did I mess it up?
Yeah, Sawatari, thank you.
Sawatari, thanks so much for being with us. Now, this procedure, and I think some of us heard about it in the news, saw it on television, and specifically, you worked on Sharon, who goes by Kay Thornton, a 60-year-old who went blind 9 years ago from a rare disease or disorder called Stevens-Johnson syndrome, which left the surface of her eyes so severely scarred she was legally blind. That correct? And this procedure has been dubbed MOOKP, which stands for a modified, and it's funny to me that it's modified since I didn't even know it existed, so didn't know we had to modify it, but a modified osteoodontokeratoprosthesis, right?
Yes.
Can you please explain what this is for the listeners that haven't actually heard about this yet?
Yeah, it's basically there's a certain group of patients who have severe scarring on their eye, and usually from Stevens-Johnson syndrome or like chemical burns on their eye. There aren't too many treatment options. Usually ophthalmologists oftentimes put corneal transplants.
Yes.
For it, but some that certain severely scarred population can't have that. So what they do is they take an artificial lens, a plastic lens, and they mount it to something, and then they implant it into the eye. And in our case, the MOOKP is a tooth and bone surrounding a tooth and the acrylic lens, and that's implanted onto the eye.
That's really neat. Doctor, I'm having a little trouble hearing you. I'm not sure if my listeners are, so if there's if it's something as simple as putting your mouth closer to the phone, that would be great.
Okay.
Oh, that would be super. Now, this was the first time done in the United States, although my understanding is this procedure has been done about 600 times worldwide. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so the first one, July 9th of 2009, and yet I think I'm trying to remember when the actual first surgery was done. I may have it here in my notes. But why does it take so long to get these procedures here in the U.S.?
I think part of it is acceptance. It's such a bizarre procedure that we didn't really accept it much, but what happened was two things. One is Falcinelli, who's the person who's responsible for the M in the title, the modification.
Oh, okay.
He put out a paper that had 30 years of follow-up study. So when you put out a paper with 30 years of success, then all of a sudden we're much more interested in doing it. Because in medicine dentistry, there are a lot of different procedures, but not all of them are accepted. But for this country, I think what it required was good long-term follow-up studies, evidence-based medicine, and the ophthalmology team at Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute decided to tackle the problem and adopt the procedure. The other reason that they decided to adopt it is because there weren't too many other treatment options for these severely scarred patients. So I think those were the two driving forces. One was a long-term follow-up, and the other one was because there were no other good alternative treatments for it.
I see. Now, yesterday I was at a vaccination clinic. I volunteered to vaccinate folks against H1N1, and one of the nurses there was asking me a little bit. I said, you need to tune in because this is going to be a really neat story. And she was very curious about why we use a tooth. Why not something else? And of course, I think I know the answer, but why do you use... I mean, is there anything else in the body that will work like a tooth?
Not really. That's the whole unique. You know, the original founder of this procedure is a guy named Strampelli, and he's from Italy, and I think he's a genius because it utilizes and takes advantage of all components of the tooth, the periodontal ligament, the bone, and the periosteum around this whole graft to make these things work. A lot of people have tried different prostheses in the past, and the biggest problem with prosthetics in the eye is that it gets extruded or kicked out by the eye. But if you take your own tooth, bone, and cells around everything, then the body tends to accept it much better.
So take me through this procedure, because I read two different examples, three, but one, they took this piece of this tooth with the bone and the membrane still attached, and then they implanted it in the person's cheek, I hear, or I read, and in your case, you guys implanted this cube, if you will, in the person's shoulder for a couple weeks. So I may have just given out some misinformation, so why don't you take me through the whole process, because I know when I told somebody that, well, first they put it in their shoulder, then they let it sit there for a while, and then they got it and got it out and put it in their inner eye. That seemed a little bit strange to them, so...
Sure. It's a multi-stage procedure, actually. The first procedure is usually the preparation of the eye, so removal of the scar tissue. Then we take some buccal mucosa and we graft it onto the eye.
Okay, so a buccal mucosa, for my listeners, is the inside lining of your cheek.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and that's sutured onto the surface of the eye. After that, we go ahead and resect, meaning we cut out a section of bone with the tooth inside the bone from the upper jaw or lower jaw. And in Sharon's case, we took the upper jaw.
It can be either jaw, which I didn't realize, but it's always a cuspid, right?
Yeah, and the reason it's a canine or cuspid tooth is because it has the widest dimension from front to back.
Buccolingual?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And because of that, that gives you the largest lens that you can mount into the tooth, because the lens itself has to be mounted within the confines of the tooth itself.
So that means, ideally, then a maxillary cuspid, an upper cuspid, is almost always better then?
Yes.
Unless there's a small eye socket, I guess.
Yes.
Okay.
So then after the tooth is removed from the patient's jaw, this tooth and bone combination is shaved down to approximately a 1.5 centimeter by 1 centimeter by probably about 4 millimeter thickness rectangular plate.
1.5 centimeters,
yes.
And there's 2.54 centimeters per inch, right?
Yes.
So we're talking about something about, I'm going to say, would that be like a little less than half an inch?
Yes, I'd say about 3/4 by 1/2 by probably 1/4 of an inch thickness.
Okay. I know they tried to convert us to metric in the U.S. It didn't work, so I'm thinking that people don't know what a 1.5 centimeter is. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No problem. Once we shave it down to that shape, then we go ahead and drill a hole into the middle of the tooth itself.
Okay, so this would be from from the person's face back towards their palate, that direction.
Well, no, we've already removed the tooth-bone combination out of the patient's mouth.
But that's the direction you're going to use, though, isn't it? The from front to back, so to speak?
So we shaved it down to basically what's left is half the tooth.
And while you're shaving it, does it have to be kept moist? Is it kept in saline, kept in the person's own saliva? How do you keep this vital, not vital, but you know what I mean, I guess, from getting dried out and splintering and all that?
With saline.
Saline, okay. So it's completely immersed in saline and kept that way the whole time?
Well, we spray it with saline while we're... It's just like the dental handpiece. As you're using it, all the water sprays out.
Right.
Some guy on the side is sitting there, you know, irrigating while you're sitting there shaving the tooth out.
Okay, because you have to keep the heat to a minimum.
Exactly.
Okay.
So then you get it down to this rectangle. You remove the crown of the tooth, and then you drill a hole through the tooth in through the flat surface of it. Does that make sense?
A hole through the flat surface. So you've shaved it to a cube, basically, you know, well, it's a rectangle.
Yes.
Rectangular-shaped cube. And so you basically you have this entire root. I'm going to picture this. You've extracted a tooth. It has the crown still on it and the root. And you've gone somewhere onto the root surface and made your flattened area?
Yes.
Okay, so you're not using enamel, then. You're using cementum and dentin.
Exactly. It's the dentin.
Okay.
The root dentin.
Okay, good. Root dentin. So right up above the gum line for listeners that are trying to picture this, the part that you don't see.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, the crown is cut off. We drill the hole, and then we glue an acrylic lens, a plastic lens, into the tooth itself.
All right. Now, as you know, the teeth are hollow, so you've got the nerve center. What happens in the pulp chamber or the root canal system? What goes there? Anything, or you just ignore it and go through it?
All that is removed and ignored.
Just ignore it, okay. You take out any vital tissue, and the fact that there's a little hole in the middle, almost like a knot in wood, I guess, is just ignored. Okay.
So then we glue the lens, and then we implant it in the cheek itself.
Oh, you do implant it in the cheek. Now, let me back up. The glue. What glue is compatible with life? Is it the cyanoacrylate, super glue, basically?
No, it's a methyl methacrylate.
Okay. Okay. Methyl methacrylate is what we use for dentures, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So you have the lens, and this lens... who developed the lens? How long did the same?
There are different companies that do that, but measurements are taken on the patient prior to the surgery so that they know the length of the eyeball itself.
Right.
So that when the lens is placed, it will focus the image and light onto the appropriate place on the back of the eye.
And those measurement, is that a CT scan?
Not exactly, no, but remember, ophthalmologists have all these fancy machines and that can measure the exact dimension of the length of the eye.
Okay.
So this was custom made and prepared for the patient.
Okay. Well, that's good. And, so now you have the lens glued on, and you implant it in her cheek, so I was right about that. So you make an incision. This whole thing now, you said, is less than quarter of an inch by, what was the widest dimension?
It's about 3/4 of an inch long.
Okay. And so you put it in the right, left cheek. Does it really matter? You can stay away from the parotid gland and stents and duct.
Yeah. It's in the cheek, but on the skin side. So it's right underneath the skin is what it is. So a skin incision is made underneath the eye, and it is implanted underneath that.
Oh, okay. Okay,
so
see, I had that up completely. See, I'm glad I had you on the line. I was giving these people bad information. All right, so now you've implanted it in the cheek, but you've gone in through just like the inferior orbital area?
Yeah.
Right below the eye socket?
Yes.
So it's not really in the eye yet, but it's up there getting nutrition or staying moist and allowing the body to accept it rather than think of it as a foreign object?
Exactly.
And that's the whole purpose, right? It's because it's like a little trial run.
Exactly. It's meant to revitalize the tissue, because once you remove it, it doesn't really die, but it's close to it because it's deprived of oxygen and things like that. It's nutrients. So you replant it to maintain its vitality.
Okay, how soon after it's been extracted does it have to be reimplanted?
You have about 4 to 6 hours to replant it before cells really start dying.
Okay, that's plenty of time then to do what you're wanting to do. Did you feel pressure?
To succeed?
Well, I mean, let's face it, she only has so many cuspids. I guess you could have, if you made a mistake, you could have used another cuspid. But I imagine there was probably quite a bit of pressure to make sure that your part of it was done absolutely perfectly.
Absolutely.
And I know that... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Yeah, it was horrible. Yeah, the pressure was horrible. There were, like, lots of people in the operating room considering it was the first time in America. I mean, it was pretty nerve-wracking, to say the least. Which leads me to the next point, and you're right about the cheek and the chest. What happened after we implanted into the cheek was she developed a sinus infection, and then we had to remove the graft from her cheek and reimplant it into her chest.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So technically, yes, we put it into the cheek, but for Sharon's case, we actually had to move it away from the infected area.
That's okay. So that's where I got my what I thought were crossed signals, but they were actually both right.
Yes.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Dr. Yos Sawatari. I'm sorry, Sawatari, who is an oral surgeon who helped Sharon K. Thornton's age 60 regain her sight after being blind for 9 years. She had suffered from a rare disorder called Stevens-Johnson syndrome, which left her eye so severely scarred that she was legally blind. But the doctors determined that the inside of her eyes were still functional enough that she might one day see with the help of this MOOKP procedure. Do you actually try to pronounce the word, or you just, do you call it MOOKP because it's like mooked? That doesn't really fly, does it?
Yeah, I just call it MOOKP.
Okay, and so modified osteoodontokeratoprosthesis. All right, that's what this is now being called. I guess it's been that way for a while. So if you have questions for Dr. Sawatari, call 821-1230. And if you're just getting up and it's 16 minutes after the hour and you think we're talking about restoring somebody's eyesight with a tooth and you thought you were dreaming, you're not. This is real. This happened July 9th down in Florida at the University of Florida, Gainesville, correct?
Yeah, the timing is a little bit different. This is, a multi-stage procedure.
Okay, when did it start and how long did it take to end?
I believe the first stage was complete on March 6th, and then our final procedure, or the last stage of it, where we took the graft and put it in place into the patient's eye, was September 6th, I believe. That was a Friday before Labor Day weekend.
Oh, okay, September 6th. Oh, I see that. You know what I'm getting my July number is this gentleman that had one done in the UK was July 9th of 2009, and I might mention that a little bit. But yeah, so this article on ABC News was September 17th, about 9 days, I can't do math, 11 days after you actually finished. Okay, so now, as an oral surgeon, you only use your drill now if you are sectioning bone or sectioning a tooth to extract or do a sliding osteotomy or something. It had been a long time since you'd actually drilled on a tooth in a way that it mattered, hasn't it? Hadn't it?
Yes.
Which kind of added to the stress, I'm thinking.
Yes.
Because I have to say, when I read the story and learned a little bit about you, I thought that must have been even more nerve-wracking for him than... can you picture like an orthodontist doing this? They haven't used their drill in like 30 years.
It's like riding a bike. You know, I was a general dentist for a while before I went to oral surgery, so it wasn't bad.
Yeah, yeah. No, obviously you're qualified to do it or they wouldn't have asked you, but I can understand the concern over making sure you got it right. Now, you know, we spend a lot of time on this show talking about how important teeth are, and the more I do this show, the more I realize it, because, anywhere from, and I'm going to get this wrong, but I know that they identified a mummy in the Egyptian museum. They were looking for, I think it was King Tut's aunt or something, and it turns out they found it right there in the museum. It was an unidentified mummy, and it turned out that they found that there was a tooth that helped them discover that it was her, and... obviously, teeth are used for forensics. That's how we identify bodies that are found and so on. So teeth just keep... They continually amaze me in how important... I mean, you know, the jaw starts to calcify 6 weeks in utero. I mean, it's the very first bone that starts to form. And so hopefully people over time are going to understand just how important it is that they take care of their teeth. And it's funny because at the end of the article... about Susan, and I forget who was quoted as saying this, but it was something about how she says when she gets her sight back, it's amazing, and then it says, let me just read it here, it says, and I wish I'll have to find out who said this. Oh, it's a quote, it says, we're keeping it as, oh, I know, this was from, I wonder if it was from Dr. Perez. Yeah, it was from Dr. Perez. Okay, Dr. Perez was involved as well. And he said, quote, we're keeping it as a spare tire, meaning they only did one eye. You only did one eye for now. And it says, if there's any infection, I'm optimistic we can preserve at least, if there isn't any infection, Dr. Perez is optimistic that they can preserve at least her 20/70 vision for the next 10 years. For now, he won't try to fix Thornton's other eye. Here's the quote. We're keeping it as a spare tire. If something goes wrong with the first eye, we can do the other. That way, she will always have a chance at vision. And then he goes on to say, as long as she takes care of her teeth. Which I thought that was... Okay, so all you people listening out there, take care of your teeth because you might need it to restore your eyesight someday, right?
Absolutely. If she didn't take care of her teeth, she wouldn't have any of those teeth that we could use to produce a prosthesis. So, and she still has other canines that we can utilize, so... That's absolutely right.
Right. So anybody sitting out there thinking their teeth are so bad, they're just going to get dentures someday, hey, don't think that way because teeth are very important. And, in fact, so important, they could actually restore your sight someday. I see that I went a little bit into my commercial break, so we're going to have to go to a commercial. When we come back, we're going to talk more with Dr. Sawatori. And, hey, we'll be right back.
Hold on, Selecta.
Welcome back to Dentally Speaking. You're listening to Dr. Kavitko, and today we have with us on the show is Dr. Sawatori, Dr. Yo Sawatori. And Dr. Sawatori was involved in the procedure that was done down at the University of Florida, Gainesville, where a woman, Susan K. Thornton, her eyesight was restored by using a tooth. And actually, I was so interested in this story, Doc, that I forgot to actually give people information about yourself. I'm sorry about that. Let me just give out a little bit of information about you. Dr. Sawatori is an assistant professor of clinical surgery at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine, which is a division of in the division of oral and maxillofacial surgery. I don't know why I can't talk. Maybe I should have a radio show, huh? Anyway, he received a Bachelor of Science degree from the University of Michigan, which we won't hold against him, and a Doctorate of Dental Surgery from the University of Michigan School of Dentistry. As a general dentist, he served in the Public Health Service / Indian Health Service for 5 years on the Navajo Reservation in Arizona. He then completed an oral and maxillofacial surgery residency at the University of Miami Jackson Memorial Hospital. After 2 years of private practice, he returned to the University of Miami as a full-time faculty. Dr. Sawatori is a diplomat of the American Board of Oral and Maxillofacial Surgery, and his surgical interests include trauma, pathology, and dento-alveolar surgery. And now, restoring eyesight, I guess you would want to add to that, right? I'm sorry, do we still have you?
Yes.
Okay, good, good. I thought I heard a little something, but I wasn't sure. So so that 2 years as a general dentist is what turns out to have become very valuable.
It was 5 years on the Indian Reservation.
Oh, and the 5 years on the Indian Reservation, okay. Okay, so 7 years as a GP, and then you decided you wanted to be an oral surgeon. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about when you said you took tissue and you placed it inside the eye, the membrane, you took a piece of the cheek. How thick, is it just the epithelial layer, just the very outer layer? And
yes.
What does it get stitched to?
It gets, the skin surface on the eye is called the conjunctivum.
Okay.
Basically, you remove the scarred and damaged portion of it, and you basically take the skin inside the mouth and attach it to the edge of the good skin on the inner aspect of the eye, underneath the eyelid.
Okay.
You essentially replace the entire visible surface of the front of the eye. So if you spread your eyelids open and you see the whole white section,
yes,
that whole section is replaced with the skin on the inside of your mouth.
And is ultimately, I think I saw a picture, ultimately is that later covered with a contact lens of some sort that looks like an eye?
Exactly.
Okay. Well, it's pretty neat what they have with contacts because people are able to change the color of their eye, and you see in movies sometimes they'll put a white contact lens to make the person look ghostly or something. And so the membrane now then, or rather the outer surface, is cheek tissue. So it's more than just doing this with a tooth. It's cheek tissue, and then a contact lens is placed over top. And to the average person, you can't even tell this has been done.
Yes.
Was it her right eye or her left? It was her left. Okay. So in the picture that I've seen, her right eye looks normal, but she can't see out of it.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's the key. The eye has to essentially be undamaged and just not able to traverse the scar tissue or whatever.
Yes, it's as if somebody put an opaque piece of glass over the front of your eye, so you can't see because the vision is affected by somebody placing like a cover over your eye. So the nerve, the area that takes in light and perceives the images is all intact. It's just the front part of the eye is so scarred that as if somebody took a shade and put it over your eye.
Yeah, and I think that's important for even me to understand, because when you talk about putting an artificial lens, I conjured up thoughts of, you know, lots of little mini wires attached to the brain somehow, and that's not the case. All of the cones and rods that are on the retina, those all were fully functioning.
That's exactly right.
And how did they know that? How did they know that?
Well, the smart ophthalmologists are very good at analyzing patients and knowing exactly how everything is responding. There is a certain amount of uncertainness, because once we place the lens, the prosthesis, onto the patient's eye, in the operating room, we had a retina specialist come in. Dr. Perez had a retina specialist come in and actually take a look at the retina and focus the lens onto that. So it does require an additional evaluation during the surgery itself.
Okay. And cones and rods, for my listeners, cones are the ones that will allow us to see color, correct? And rods are black and white?
Yes.
Oh, I'm glad I didn't get that backwards.
It's light.
It's been a while since I've had that in school, but... okay, now, I'm sorry. So, and you know what? We went to our commercial break late last time, so I think I'm going to go on time this time. But before we go to the break, let me just give out, we had a couple of people call during our last commercial break with guesses to our question of the day. Kathleen called in a guess of 17%, and Richard called in a guess of 42%. And the question was, according to the ADA, what percent of dentists had ever known or suspected employee substance abuse in 2007? So keep your guesses coming in. You're listening to Dentally Speaking here on AM 1230 WYTS, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Dentally Speaking. You're listening to Dr. Brian Kavitko here this morning on a Sunday morning, a great Sunday morning. The sun is shining. It's a little bit cold, but the sun's shining. Of course, here in Columbus it's cold. I'm guessing it's not that cold down there in Florida. Dr. Salvatore, what's the temperature like down there? I think we lost him. Oh, what is it?
75.
That's not fair. and it's 42 degrees here. So, gee, how much would you sell me? 35 degrees? Anyway, now, I said it's sunny. It's probably beautiful where you are. And if you're out in your car listening to this, or you're just sitting at home, I want everybody to look outside and just see how beautiful it is. And just think about how awful it would be if all you saw were black, just pitch black. If you had your sight for about 50 years and then, or 51 years, and then you lost it. And Dr. Salvatore, along with Dr. Perez and a couple others, which I hope I can name here, Dr. Rick Brister, right?
And Rick Brister is Sharon's companion and friend.
Oh, he's not. I'm sorry. He's not. He wasn't on the team. He's just sitting next to her.
Yes.
Okay, boy, I'm glad I had you here to confirm, straighten me out. So it was yourself, Dr. Perez, and you mentioned another gentleman.
There are quite a few, but Dr. Perez was the lead ophthalmologist for the team.
Right.
There was a...
Falcinelli?
Falcinelli is the Italian surgeon who modified the original procedure.
You're kidding. He was there?
Yes. What we had the luxury of having him and his son there.
What was that like?
Oh, it was fantastic. He's like 80-some years old, 86 or something, and he flew over to the United States for... every single procedure except the final one.
Wow. So,
by himself.
Starting in March,
yes.
He came for that procedure, which was originally extracting the tooth. No, that was cleaning out the scar tissue and putting the cheek membrane on.
Well, those are all different procedures we did at different times, but the first procedure did involve removing the tooth and the bone and implanting into the cheek.
Wow. Does he speak English?
No, he does not.
Okay. I went to a benefit piano concert last night for to raise money for polio, sponsored by the Rotary International, which I'm a member of. And this gentleman Antonio Carsani, and he did not speak English, but boy, can he play piano. After he was finished, he had just a few English words that he had learned, and it was very, very cute, and it was very nice of him to even try, because most of us only speak one language. And so, did he have an interpreter?
Yes, his son is fluent in English, so his son, who was also very competent in this procedure, translated for us.
Oh, okay, okay. Do you think there's a chance that this procedure will become standard in the U.S.?
I think we have we have to do many more of these to make it sort of standard, per se. We apparently have 10 more patients lined up at this point who we have to work up and do the appropriate studies and things like that. And if we can continue to have successes, then I think it will be a much more accepted procedure in the country.
Okay. Well, it's really nice to know that this is out there now. Now, I know you talked about how there was lots of pressure, but how did you prepare for the procedure? What did you do different, or did you spend time reading, studying, praying? I mean, what did you do in preparation?
there's an article that Dr. Falcinelli released a couple years back that goes over his long-term success with this procedure, plus it goes through all his modifications and step-by-step procedure itself. So I must have read that at least 12 times, because the first six, I couldn't understand what it was talking about.
Was it in Italian?
No, it was in English, but it's just such an outlandish procedure that it was hard to conceptualize at first.
It's like reading a technique card, but a really, really involved technique card.
Yeah, because at first, you know, when somebody presented this, the ophthalmology team presented to our division, we were like, what are they talking about? Because it's so just out of the ordinary. But after reading it multiple times, Dr. Falcinelli came over and he showed us a video of it. He showed us, he helped us with cadaver studies.
Okay.
And then Dr. Perez and myself, we went over to the cadaver lab and utilized that. And also we practiced on extracted teeth. And we read a couple more articles. And we just basically, it was more of a planning issue than anything else.
Okay. Had to have everything all ready because you knew he was going to fly over, and once he got there, all the team just had to be all set. And you couldn't be asking too many questions at that point, right?
Exactly. I think we initially met between us and the ophthalmology team, Dr. Falcinelli, in August of 2008, and we didn't actually perform the procedure until March of 2009.
Wow. September, October. And I'm assuming you guys did this all on your own time.
Yeah.
No compensation.
No.
And that it was. Does that mean that a lot of these meetings, you had to close your office to have these meetings, or did you try to do them on the weekend, or how did that go?
It's usually after hours for us, or before. So, yeah, we do what we can, but of course we still have to see our patients, and flow is as normal as it goes. But these are new or additional procedures, you have to just invest more time, and that usually means after hours.
Right, and I think a lot of, I think just the public at large, they don't understand that. They probably think that everybody got rich off this surgery, and you guys all did it out of the kindness of your heart, and of course, some of it was just the pure excitement of being able to help this person.
Absolutely. The patient is such a nice lady. You just wanted to do everything you could for her, which also explains why I was so anxious and to make it succeed.
Yeah. Now, how many grandchildren does she have? Was it 7 or 17? I'm trying to remember.
I think it's 9.
Oh, 9 grandchildren.
And she's seen 2 of them. She hasn't seen the 7 youngest ones.
Until now?
Until now.
Wow. So, think of that. 7 grandchildren that you've never seen. She must have cried for days.
Oh, it was incredibly emotional when we took the bandages off and she saw her friend Rick Brister for the first time in 9 years, and she had recognized him.
Oh, wow.
She had said that he looks whiter than before. And then she was looking at the TV, and she said, I can see the TV. It was a commercial on. She was like, I see yellow, I see blue. And then Dr. Perez put a chart, you know, the eye chart in front of her,
yeah.
An eye chart card, and she could read the letters, and boy, you know, we were all very emotional. It's a feeling that's unmatched, you know.
Yeah.
To be honest with you.
It really is, yeah. I can't imagine. The closest I've come would be doing a smile makeover for somebody, which oftentimes elicits tears of joy as well.
Absolutely.
But this has to be heads and tails above that. We do have to go to another commercial break. You're able to hang with us a little longer, right?
Sure.
Okay, thanks so much for that. We'll be right back. Before I go to break, let me just remind folks this show is available by podcast by going to www.am1230wyts.com. Hold your mouth over the on-air button. Dr. Kvitko will pop up on a long list of other on-air talent, and click on that. Takes you to my podcast, and there's a spot that says go to podcast page. All right, you're listening to Dunley Speaking on AM 1230 WYTS, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Dentally Speaking. Today my guest is Dr. Yo Sawatori. Dr. Sawatori helped Susan K. Thornton regain her eyesight by working with a team of ophthalmologists, Dr. Perez, and also got to work with, it was Dr. Frenicelli, is that how you say it?
Falcinelli.
Falcinelli, okay. This 80-some-year-old gentleman from Italy who came over to kind of supervise. Now, before I move on, because I get so interested in what you're saying that I'm afraid I'm going to forget some of these things, such as we had a couple guesses over the break. One was an email, one was a phone call. Ted sent us an email. He says 56% of dentists had ever known or suspected employee substance abuse in 2007, and Mitch guessed, a phone call guessed 9%. And let's see, I think I'll give out the answer a little bit later, so remember to give us your calls, give us your guesses. You can also find out more information about this show by going to dentallyspeaking.com. We have updates on upcoming guests and upcoming topics there. So, and you can follow me on Twitter by going to www.twitter.com/Dr. Kvitko. And Dr. Kvitko is spelled D-R-K-V-I-T-K-O. All right? Okay, now, Dr. Sawatori, I wanted to find out, first of all, I think you told me, but I'm not sure, why use a tooth? I mean, is there nothing else in the body that would work besides a tooth?
Yeah, it's the advantage of a tooth is its rigidity and the ability to cement acrylic lens onto it.
Okay.
Plus, you have to recruit bone also, so if we were just to take a tooth and put it into the eye, it would most likely be rejected.
Right.
But the tooth, the bone surrounding the tooth keeps the PDL, or the periodontal ligament, or the layer around the tooth alive.
Right.
And that prevents the rejection of the tooth itself, which is actually holding the lens. So it's a combination of the different tissues that we transplant that makes this whole process work.
And is there any blood supply actually established to this this cube or not?
Yes, it is.
There is. So it's being bathed in blood by some vessel or... What?
When you transplant it into the cheek or the chest like we did, then it regenerates a blood supply to it. And when you read some of the papers that they have in Italy, they've actually looked at the samples under the microscope and found that the bone is still alive, the periodontal ligament or that layer of cells around the root is still alive, and so everything has regained life and maintained life in the eye itself.
Wow, that's actually pretty phenomenal when you think about it.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Especially since, you know, in the mouth, if you lose bone around a tooth, it's the only place in the body where you can't regrow bone.
Yeah.
And yet we can take bone attached to a tooth and keep it vital for, according to Dr. Perez, at least 10 years. I think that's just a guess. Or is that based on the studies of the original founding doctor?
Yes, I think the longest follow-up was 25 years from Dr. Falcinelli.
Okay, 25 years. That's
so
pretty good.
I'm sorry?
That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's fantastic. If every patient had a 25-year success, I think that's a very successful procedure.
I mean, yeah, if it happened to, a 9-year-old, I don't know if you can do it in someone who's still growing, but let's say you had to wait till they were finished growing. Well, their eye socket is normal, is already full size, though, at birth,
yeah.
Isn't it? So you do it to a 9-year-old, or maybe let me do 10 so I can do the math in my head better, and then 25 years, they'd be 35, another 25 years, they'd be 60, and another 25 years, they'd be 85. So literally, this could be done a few times in a person's lifetime and keep them with vision.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, we talked a little bit about how it made you feel when the patient could see, but you had to be on cloud 9 for quite a while. think, and you still are.
To say the least, it was pretty emotional again, and, you know, for her to be so happy, it's basically for Sharon, you just imagine, and it's difficult for me and all of us to imagine being blind for 9 years and then being able to see, but just to imagine that, the joy that she must feel, the ability to see her grandkids again, I mean, that's just phenomenal, and... yeah, I was feeling pretty good for a while, for sure.
And if your wife's like my wife, she'd make a comment about your head won't fit in the door anymore or something. You know, wives always bring you right back down to reality, won't they?
I lost a lot of sleep during the procedure. It was very nerve-wracking, as I described. And, you're always humbled by surgery and the medical profession in general. So you just got to keep grounded and keep on plugging away and doing what you have to do. And you just try to do the best, like we all do.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to find out, since I do encourage people to take good care of their teeth, and I on one hand, I kind of hate the fact that we think a tooth is something you can sacrifice, which we both agree is certainly fine in this case. But what did you do in the spot where the tooth used to be?
Well, initially I attempted to bone graft it, and that actually got infected, and that's somewhat the same reason why we had to transplant it.
Was it a block bone graft, or?
It was a particulate. It was like a mashed up bone.
So, graft. Did you use a mixture of cancellous and cortical bone?
Yes, and that was from a tissue bank. So, I think I pushed the limit a little too far, and I paid the price. That explains why I'm probably a lot more gray than I used to be, and I lost a lot of sleep during the procedure. So. But in the future, what I will do is attempt the bone graft again and put dental implants in place or a removal of prosthesis, whatever the patient desires.
Okay, so right now she just is missing that tooth?
Yes.
Okay. So but in her, once the bony area is infection-free and it's healed, your plan is to go back and try bone grafting again a second time, let it heal for 6 months, go back in with a dental implant, and 6 months later a crown on that?
Yeah.
Okay. My producer is telling me it's time for a break again, so hang with us, please, and we'll be right back.
You know I can't smile without you.
Welcome back to Dentally Speaking, here with Dr. Kavitko and Dr. Yo Sawatori from Florida, who it's 75 degrees down there. I think we're all jealous. We only have 42 degrees to rub together up here in Columbus, but at least it is sunny. And... it went up a degree. I just got the indication from my producer. It's now 43 degrees. So, anyway, all right. So now, Dr. Sawatori, first of all, before we run out of time, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. Is there anything that you would like my listeners to know or me to know about this procedure in general before we run out of time?
It's just a pleasure for our profession, our dental profession, to be able to contribute to such a life-changing surgery. And hopefully, you know, the dental profession can continue to contribute to these kind of procedures so that, we do good for society. It's the way I feel about it all.
Yeah, no, I was going to say you've done dentistry proud, and dentists were an interesting lot, aren't we? Because we were tinkerers, a lot of times we're OCD, we don't seem to need much sleep, and I think we both know that general anesthesia was discovered by a dentist, local anesthesia was discovered by a dentist, all kinds of neat things that the dental community does and continues to do. And so I'm sorry to hear about U of M losing yesterday. I guess it was a last second touchdown by Iowa. Iowa was tough this year.
Yeah.
I have a feeling they might just kick our butt too. But anyway, no, I have a hygienist who's from the U of M, so we have a friendly rivalry. Hasn't been quite as fun lately, but I know Michigan is going to be back and strong, and they'll start kicking our butt again here next couple. Well, no, not hopefully, as far as I can see. Where I sit, but anyway, hopefully from where you sit. But anyway, so let's see, I need to give out, do you have a guess for the question of the day? I'm just curious, what would your guess have been?
Oh, my guess?
Yeah.
50%?
You think, you're one of those people that's like you flip a coin. there's always a comedian in the bunch. Every week somebody guesses 50%, which is like saying they don't know. Anyway, the answer is 26%. I don't know if you consider that high or low. Think about it, a fourth of... of dentists have known or suspected employee substance abuse. That's honestly, that's actually higher than the national average for people that are dependent, chemically dependent in some way, and higher than the true numbers for dentists. Did you realize that? It's like 15 to 17% national average, and dentists also, and yet 26% of dentists have ever known or suspected employee substance abuse. Not sure why that is, although I actually have had some of it at my office that I've had to deal with. So, anyway, if Dr. Sawatari, I keep saying that wrong, I'm so sorry, Sawatari, if somebody wanted to reach you, how would they do that?
They could probably email me if they'd like. It's ysawatari@med.miami.edu with any questions regarding anything they've heard. I'd be happy to respond.
Okay, that sounds great. Thanks so much for doing that. And again, thanks for being on my show. And good luck with the other procedures that you guys have in the pipeline, and I'll be watching. So, thanks so much for joining me. Tune in next Sunday morning at 9 for another episode of Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko. Everything you've always wanted to know about dentistry, but we're too numb to ask.